Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Air FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and today myself and my co-presenter John Dorney from the Irish Story website are very pleased to be joined by Dr. David Convery. David has edited a collection of essays entitled Locked Out, A Century of Irish Working Class Life, which was launched last night in Liberty Hall. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the programme, you can go to the Air FM podcast page on nairfm.ie/podcast and check us out. David, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
First off, I think we should ask the question, how do you define class?
Class is actually quite a difficult thing to define. There are a few definitions of it. The one I generally favour is the economic one, that you have people who control capital, wealth, and the means of producing wealth. So people who own businesses, factories, corporations, and so on. They're what could be termed capital class, and they're generally the people who run society, who politicians are generally linked to. Fianna Fáil is obviously well known for getting donations from businessmen and so on. And then there'll be the working class who have to work for a living to produce a wage and don't really own the means of creating wealth in any independent way themselves, don't have any sort of power over other people. Then there's people in the middle, which is a more of a broader category. These things are all fluid, and it's important to keep that in mind, I think, to a sense. In the past, middle-class people would have been a far more solid block. So you would have had, say, at the beginning of the 20th century, groups like teachers would have been considered quite a middle-class profession. But today, teachers are in a very different situation altogether, especially newer teachers starting out. They're in trade unions, sometimes precarious positions, long working hours, and lower wages, especially for new entrants into teaching. So class is a fluid thing, but the main categories, I think, are working class and the upper class or capitalist class. Middle class as well will include small business owners who employ, you know, a few people and don't own much capital. Then there's the other definition, which kind of is related, but has to do with identity and how you identify yourself as belonging to a particular class. Now, in Ireland and in the United States as well, would be another notable example. Class, it's not stratified in people's consciousness, as Britain would be, for instance. There's a very strong working class identity in Britain. There's a very strong identity of people who belong to the elite. And in Ireland, that doesn't really exist. And in the United States, that doesn't really exist. I think in Ireland, we have the idea that the working class generally are the most deprived in society. That you know, unless you're living on a council estate or something like that, then you're not working class. And then you have the people at the very top, the very rich, who are obviously you know, an upper class. And then I think that the broad perception is that somewhere everyone else belongs in the middle. But I don't think that's actually accurate. I think that we haven't really developed the class consciousness that exists to the same extent as would in Britain and in other places like Germany and so on. But class divide does still actually exist in the economic terms, and I think that's one of the important things that the book tries to highlight, that the class divisions are extant in Irish society, even if we don't acknowledge them openly.
Hi David, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
One thing that strikes me, though, the classic division of class is obviously urban, but historically in Ireland, much of the population was rural, and at one point you had a very specific elite, which was the landowning elite. Mm. But even when they were largely removed in the various land acts, there were also class divisions in the countryside. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the things that's addressed in Liam Cullen's chapter at the very beginning of his chapter, that you have, for instance, a district court judge in Limerick who refused to believe that the labouring, agricultural labourers and farmers belong to different class of people, and refused to rule in favour of the agricultural labourers as a result. When they were in dispute with the farmers. So that is a clear class divide that does exist in the countryside, and which has been covered over in Irish history, I think.
Yeah, which is, we'll get onto this more specifically, but I mean, I was looking at the border counties in 1922-23, the years of the Civil War, but also general upheaval. And there's a farmers' meeting in Monaghan. There's a few actually where they talk like this, but one in particular where the treasurer of the farmers' union says the farmer has to sleep with a revolver under his pillow because he's afraid of his labourers. You know, was really pressing at various points.
Mm. And there are particular points when that does come to the fore. During the War of Independence and Civil War, there was huge mass protests involving violence, occupation and so on, occupation of the land by landless labourers, and so on, again, not just against the big estates, but against just the general farmers who owned, you know, more land than the landless and weren't obviously giving them rights to ownership or access to the land.
And wages were going down is the big problem.
Absolutely, yeah. And so you have as well, I mean, you have in the countryside, you have the occupation of all those creameries as well that were declared Soviets. Brewery ones where they raised the banner, we make butter, not profits. You know? There are certain points in Irish history when the class struggle comes to the fore, I think, and that is one of them. And I think that more research needs to be applied to uncovering those sort of things if we can actually truly understand the dynamics of Irish history.
One thing which you'd remark on from this end of the 20th century, or we're now 21st, of course, is that the class structure has changed because the agricultural labour doesn't really exist anymore.
No. No, it doesn't. And as I said earlier with the example of the teachers, class is it's a fluid thing. But I think as time goes on, more and more middle class professions become more working class, even if the people who, you know, even if the people themselves still identify as being middle class, their conditions of work, precarious nature of their employment, their wages, while they may be higher than the average, are still, you know, subject to the rules of the market. So you can still have, you know, engineers, IT people who at the whim of a multinational corporation can close down tomorrow and those people can be out of work. And that's the reality. Even if these people see themselves as middle class, that the economic situation in which they live is working class. And society and the economy does change over time, absolutely. The economy today is far, far different than it would have been 100 years ago, but I think the fundamental class divide still remains. And as time goes on, I think more and more people are actually being drawn into working class existence. But that obviously the image of what a working class person is hasn't really caught up with, you know, the reality of the 21st century.
I think one of the things we read from separatists and cultural nationalists before independence is that class is almost like a British construct and class conflict will disappear once there's independence.
Yeah, that's very true. But I think that there was the idea that you have society at the time that was run by a British elite and you have the Anglo-Irish gentry who owned the land and so on. But then you have, I think that there was an effort made by separatists, not just separatists, but people who would have furthered home rule as well, to create an identity of Irish, that were all Irish against Protestant English. So that was considered the alien other, and that we must all unite as Irish men, because the women were completely excluded from society, official society at least at the time. Obviously women played a massive role in furthering cause of Irish liberation and working class liberation as well at the time. But there was a conscious effort, I think, to do that, and it's smoothed over the class divide. There was an attempt as well, I think, to say that issues that do remain about poverty, class divisions, will be dealt with or will almost disappear once we gain independence. And that didn't happen. There was the idea that once you replace the Anglo-Irish gentry, we'll be a better society. And that wasn't reality at all. That smoothed over the class divisions completely. And what you actually had was you had the new state basically saying now, well, we must all be in it together to create a new state and a new identity, and we must pull our weight. It's very similar, actually, to the discourse that you get today in many ways to get out of the recession. Mm-hmm. And there is a conscious effort to smooth over the class divide. And the difference in Ireland, as opposed to other countries with a strong labour movement, because Ireland did have a very strong labour movement at the time, was the political aspect to that labour movement. And there wasn't a concerted effort, I feel, in Ireland to develop an independent political voice for the working class as there would have been in Britain and in Germany, in France and elsewhere.
Do you think that's because, in some ways, the Irish labour movement was maybe too focused on syndicalism and industrial issues at the expense of forming a political voice or organising a political movement?
I think that's an interesting thing, and it's something I think which actually has been neglected. Connolly and Larkin obviously would have been very political people. They both departed. Connolly was executed in 1916 and Larkin departed for the United States in 1914 and wouldn't return until 1923. And obviously the whole society had changed at that stage. And you had people left behind, William O'Brien, Tom Johnson and so on, who led the trade union movement. And I think that they're generally seen, especially in left-wing historical analysis of Ireland at the period, as basically selling out the labour movement, and that it's a question of leadership. And I think the question of leadership is actually a very valid concern, but the idea of syndicalism as well, syndicalism didn't really believe in developing an independent political party as such, that the union would be the political voice. And if all the workers could be organised into one big union, that we could have a general strike and capitalism would crumble. To put it simply, you know, it's more complex than that, obviously. So there was the lack of the organisation at the time. Now, the thing was, in 1918, Labour organised a mass general strike against conscription. And that's dealt with in one of the chapters of the book. But Labour really failed to take credit for that in any real sense. And Sinn Féin were allowed to kind of roll onto the back of that and, you know, sweep up in the election. And also, the Labour Party was really an appendage to the trade union movement at the time. And they really didn't want to deal with questions that could be seen as divisive, like the national question. And that was a detrimental thing completely. A real paradox, to be frank, because they wanted to go through legitimate channels at the time, which was something that Connolly and Larkin, you know, were completely opposed to. What's legitimate is what makes a difference, I think, is what they would have thought. And that if there are laws in place that make people live in terrible conditions and so on and don't grant people freedoms, then those laws are there to be broken, essentially. I think that would have been what they believed in. But the leadership of the trade union movement and the Labour Party at the time wanted to stay within the bounds of constitutionality. And I think the paradox is that, so they didn't challenge the ruling state, even when they were in a position to do so during the War of Independence, and to a lesser extent then afterwards in the Civil War. But then, during the Free State, they basically granted the Free State government legitimacy, Cumann na Gael at the time, by becoming, in effect, the official opposition. And the only reason that they were there in the first place was because of actions they didn't agree with to begin with, which were unconstitutional at the time. So that was the thing which I don't think they ever really acknowledged. And Labour has continued to the present day to actually latch on to one or the other of the main two parties and never really developed an independent political voice. And alongside an independent political voice would come a kind of maybe more of a pride in the identity of being working class, in having your own culture and your own history and developing your own cultural organisations as well, as would have existed in Britain and as a result in Ireland as well. Because of this, well, put it simply, we haven't had the same welfare state and so on as Britain would have had after the landslide election in 1945 with Labour and Clanmaitley.
Just to take it back a little bit before Irish independence and so forth, right on the eve of what we're now calling the Irish Revolution, is the Lockout, which is probably the biggest, certainly the most famous strike in Irish history. What's the importance of the Lockout? Why, 100 years on, are we having special commemorations of the Lockout?
The Lockout was, I think, the most important Labour dispute in Irish history. There are things which involve more people, like the general strike against conscription, for instance. Right. But that was in a narrow time frame as well. The lockout, from start to finish, went on for about 6 months. The last workers to go back were Jacob's workers in March 1914, after the lockout started at the end of August 1913. But most people had gone back by January 1914. But it involved the whole of the city of Dublin. At the time, you had about 20,000-25,000 workers on strike or locked out, and obviously their dependents at the time as well, their children and so on. But you also had, that would have affected perhaps 100,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Which is like between a quarter and a third of the city at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. And then you have the whole of the capitalist class, the middle class, business people, professional elite, the church and so on as well. They were all dragged into it. So it pitted the entire city, you know, into a very clear class divide. And it wasn't just about the city. I mean, the rest of Ireland doesn't really appear very much in the lockout, but one of the main players was obviously Britain. Mm. And the mass support that was given by working class people in Britain to the locked out workers of Dublin. And that was actually one of the things we actually have a problem with, I think, in Irish historiography is we tend to think of Ireland as an isolated example, as if, you know, it's not just an island geographically and physically, but it's an island historically as well, mentally, that we're cut off from the rest of the world. But that's just not the reality. I mean, Ireland was a part of the United Kingdom at the time, but even afterwards, when it wasn't, Ireland is impacted upon by events that take place throughout the world, and events that take place, Ireland also has an impact upon those events as well that take place elsewhere. And you had, from about 1910 to 1914, you had a wave of mass unrest, labour unrest in Britain called the Great Unrest. And the Dublin lockout in 1913 was part of that, and considered part of that at the time. And you had food ships coming into Dublin, sponsored by the British trade union movement. You had unofficial strike action being taking place to stop goods being transported from the ports of Britain over to Dublin as well. And so you had a mass thing that convulsed British society as well. You had Larkin speaking to, you know, 30,000 people in Manchester, you know. And he did meetings like that throughout Britain, and this is the thing, it's such an iconic thing, and it affected the whole of society. If the workers had won, obviously it would have been a great thing, and I think that history probably would have been changed without being too counterfactual about it. But even though it was lost, it lived on in folklore as a heroic struggle, as a just struggle. There's the idea that even though the workers lost, that it was a moral victory, because they kind of knew that this was the right side, and history is kind of back them on that, I think. Even if there's some attempt at the moment to kind of rebrand William Murphy as a successful businessman.
I mean, it's kind of Labour's 1916 in a way.
Yeah, it is.
Why do you think it is so powerful, though? What's the power behind the memory of it?
It affects ordinary people, particularly Dubliners. People can identify with it. These were people like them. It's the only time, in fact, really, that the working class are ever really mentioned in Irish history. Even though that's one of the things I wanted to address in the book, that the working class didn't just disappear after 1913. It's always been with us, and we need to understand that history. But that's people are able to identify with the working class of 1913 as people like them. I think if you look at, I think the commemoration of 1913 has been spearheaded really by community groups, especially from the areas that would have been most affected at the time. You see the wonderful mural and plaque put up the East Wall recently. So there's things like that, which are local people who kind of understand. Like at the launch of my book last night in Liberty Hall, I met two brothers whose grandfather was in the Citizen Army. Mm-hmm. And this is something which working class Dubliners in particular are very proud of. Mm-hmm. It's a strong tradition in their family that they stood up for their rights, you know. And even if they lost, then it was a glorious defeat in a sense.
Yeah, I think that also the issue in 1913 was union recognition was also wages. That's something, obviously it's important to the labour movement, but also, I mean, there's something that struck me if you read it, what Connolly wrote in the Workers' Republic and stuff at the time, was that it's not just about wages, it's also about power, and it's also about dignity. It's the word they keep using.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things I wanted to stress in the book, that even though the lockout started over union recognition, it was about giving the working class dignity. Larkin started the newspaper, The Irish Worker.
The Irish Worker. I just said the Workers' Republic.
No, you're grand. That was a bit after, I mean, it continued in the same vein.
Right.
But yeah, Larkin started the newspaper, The Irish Worker, which gave working class Dubliners particularly a voice. People who were like them were writing for it. People who were writing for them. They were, the amount of libel cases that went against them was incredible.
Circulation as well.
Yeah, circulation was tremendous. It was, it was a weekly paper, and it's all about 20,000 maybe on average per week, which would have been more than Sinn Féin's at the time. And that, obviously, not everyone could afford to buy it. I mean, we can't really get the figures for the readership, but I think there's a general acceptance that for every one person that bought it, you know, four or five people read it, which was remarkable. And it was really the first time, I think, that people had something which really struck a chord with them, was really written for them and by them. And it was something as well, the ITGW was a completely new departure as well, because unions had only really existed before the creation of the ITGW. They'd only really existed for skilled workers. But you have the mass of people in Dublin in particular, and in other places in the major towns and cities of Ireland, that were unskilled. And these people had absolutely no rights at all. You know, they had literally the sort of stuff that we see in films today, where people line up on the docks and get picked out for work per day. No guarantee of employment at all. No control over your own life. If the employer said to you, we're paying you less today because, you know, we're not completely satisfied with your work, there was nothing you could do about it, essentially. The court cases, if you read court cases at the time, they're a very useful resource. But they show completely the amount of working class people who were brought to jail for what would be considered petty crime today, like stealing and so on, but stealing to in order to survive. And people were living in, you know, one-room tenements. It's horrendous when you think about the actual conditions that people were living on. And these one-room tenements as well weren't just for one family. You could have multiple families that were living in the same room. And by room, I don't mean one bedroom, I mean one room. Mm-hmm. You would have had a partition, a screen put across, and you would have had big families as well at the time. These were absolutely terrible conditions. So the organising of the unskilled workers with the ITGW and the creation of the Irish Worker had a mass impact. So it was trying to organise and grant dignity and an acceptance that you actually have as much rights to a decent standard of life as anyone else. And Larkin and the ITGW embarked on a project to raise up the working class as a whole. They purchased Croydon Park as an area where you could have recreational facilities. They organised theatre classes and so on in Liberty Hall and Croydon Park because they felt that access to culture and to learning shouldn't be the preserve of the elite in society, but should belong to everyone. And I think that's another reason. I think that's really the fundamental reason, in fact, why the lockout is remembered and Larkin is remembered as a hero, and Connolly as well. And I think that it's actually, when you do look at it, when you're on, if you're on a demonstration today, or if you're reading the newspapers about demonstrations or whatever, you always hear, you know, what we need today are people like Larkin and Connolly. Mm. And, you know, that events of, I think, of 100 years ago are actually, and people that lived 100 years ago are used as the examples that we need today. It shows a complete dissatisfaction with what came after them, but it also shows the real power of the image of the project that they were engaged in, trying to raise people up and give them dignity.
Well, we're just going to take a very quick break for a moment, and we'll be back with David Convery after the break. And we're back here on the Irish History Show on Near FM with Dr. David Convery talking about Locked Out, a Century of Irish Working Class Life. Now, David, what did you think about the official attempts, the state attempts to commemorate 1913, and also some of the backlash as well from sometimes contrarians for the sake of being contrarians, but also things like business magazines and this attempt to rehabilitate William Merton Murphy?
Well, the Irish Independent, of course, is Murphy's newspaper, so it's entirely within tradition. Mm. Anyway.
I think the state commemoration of it was a very sanitised one. I think it was an attempt to, particularly on behalf of the Labour Party, to kind of reaffirm, in a sense, its supposed identity as a working class party, as the party of Larkin and Connolly, at a time when, you know, they're facing huge backlash as a result of the austerity the government is inflicting. But I don't think people buy that, to be frank. And I think I wasn't on the commemoration in Dublin, unfortunately. But from what I hear, you have a situation where you have dignitaries basically getting up and speaking. You have the actors coming in dressed in the costume of the time and so on. But from what I hear, you have a cordon around that then, where ordinary people basically, who were the people who, you know, who are the descendants of the people who participated in the lockout, you know, are in essence locked out from their own history. And I think that's in a sense, it's comical, you know, if it wasn't so tragic in a real way. And I think as well, there is all this idea in society ever since, particularly since the Celtic Tiger, that Ireland needs entrepreneurs, Ireland needs businessmen, and we need to give businessmen, entrepreneurs, the most breaks possible in order so that they can invest and create jobs, which obviously, you know, hasn't really worked very well in the last 5 years in particular. But it's still there. So you have magazines and newspapers coming out trying to portray William Martin Murphy as a great business leader. And if you look at business, well, he was a great businessman. I mean, he owned the Irish Independent, Evening Herald, the Irish Catholic. He owned Cleary's, the Imperial Hotel, Dublin United Tramway Company. He also had shares in companies, rail companies in Britain, Argentina. Massive, massive businessman. But what is this businessman, you know? I mean, a person who concentrates all that power and wealth in their own hands, is that something really to be praised in society? That tells you a lot about society itself, because the people he employed were absolutely treated horrendously. You have workers on the W90 Tramway Company, for instance, who they had to be taken on in a sense, almost in a job bridge kind of scheme, where they were taken on as trainees without any real security or any sort of wages for the first few weeks. And then months and years went by before they were given any sort of security at all. And is that something to be praised? I don't think so. But I think that the reason why this sort of image gains credit and a large audience and a lot of coverage is because, well, the media is owned by those sort of people today. It is owned by millionaires, and it does reflect their interests, I think. I don't think you have any large-scale independent media, particularly newspapers and television and so on, that really represents the mass of people at the moment. You have a lot of online stuff, and you have a lot of activist things, particularly in Dublin in recent years, but unfortunately they can only make a small impact because they're funded by volunteers. They don't have the big money behind them. And I think that's one of the things about society. We don't really accept that most of the voices that we hear are from very rich people who are completely divorced from the lives of the majority of people, and that's the voice we'll hear. So obviously we're going to hear, you know, praise and attempts to rehabilitate the memory of William Martin Murphy. And that's one of the things I think that Irish society is notorious for, and which I hope that the book can try to change in a sense. Irish society doesn't really identify itself as being class-based, and the organs of power, like I said, the media and so on, and politics as well, are the preserve of an elite, and they are the people pushing the message out. And that's been throughout history. Labour, as I said, never really developed as an independent political voice, so workers have been without a real coherent political voice on a national level. There's been times when that has broken through, like the War of Independence, and there was the PAYE strikes in the 70s and 80s, which aren't dealt with in the book, mind you, but it's an example. And I think that if we look at Irish history from a class perspective, that we can gain a far greater understanding of how it's evolved to be the way it is today, and we can get a far greater understanding as well of events. We can get new angles on what happened in the past. If we look at some of the things that we deal with today, for instance, we look Irish history looks a lot at child abuse, at the role of the Catholic Church, of the industrial schools and Magdalen laundries, and so on. And it also looks at emigration and the Irish diaspora. And the thing is, it's never really said in Irish history, and it's quite blatant, but who are the people that were being sent to industrial schools? Mm. Who were the people that were being sent to Magdalen laundries? Who were the people who were emigrating? Mm. Were working class people. People with no wealth, no access to power. You didn't have the rich and the elite in society being sent to these places. You didn't have them emigrating.
Yeah, I think as well, if you take out class as an economic factor, what you're left with is people were poor because they deserved to be poor.
Absolutely.
And as a result, they didn't deserve better than industrial schools or emigration.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of dangerous thing about that.
It's very dangerous because it's as if rich and poor are, you know, just down to chance.
Or down to moral value, even worse.
Yeah, I mean, that's you're right, absolutely. That is far worse. But it's the idea that poor because maybe you don't work hard enough, and that, you know, if you have entrepreneurial spirit or business acumen, then you could become rich. And it's as if, you know, it's the American dream, in essence, that, you know, anybody can make it. But if you don't make it, you're obviously not working hard enough, you know. The reality is, how can people work hard enough if there's no jobs to go to work?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the thing is, though, this, again, most of what I've studied is around the time of the Civil War and so forth and the founding of the Irish state. But you do see this attitude all the time. I mean, it's, you know, they're not shy about it. People like Kevin O'Higgins and Patrick Hogan, especially the Minister for Agriculture, are saying, especially at the end of the Civil War, they're very disillusioned with the Irish people as a whole. And they're saying the Irish people are lazy, you know, they don't want to work, they just want to steal, and they want to go out with the gun, and they need a firm hand, you know, and we want to promote the quality people, the farmers, the businessmen, you know, the people who are going to pay taxes, the good quality people. The rest of them, you know, they don't deserve free stuff, you know, they need the hard hand. No. So, like, it's not just rhetoric, that's actually what they're saying at the start of the Free State.
And that's very dangerous. I mean, state policy and so on is implemented on that, basically. Mm. Another thing which isn't mentioned in the book, but which I think is a good example, is the Mother and Child Scheme, which is, you know, you can have a really blatant example of class division in society and class interests. I think that's a really good one, where you have an attempt by a progressive minister for health to introduce, you know, a modicum of free healthcare for mothers and children. And you have the church, which, you know, generally has sided with the elite in society. You have the church and the politicians, who obviously were allied to the church, saying that actually the health should be the family should take care of the health of the children and not the state. That if the state takes care of it, it'll mean the almost like the apocalypse in some sense, you know. Mm-hmm. But the reality was that, of course, poor people, working class people, couldn't afford the healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that you have rich people who, you know, families, rich families, who could afford it. It was a clear class thing. Mm. And we don't look at it like that. And Irish history is like that throughout. It's not just about the big institutions that we're all in together. I think that one of the main problems of Irish history is that there is, especially in recent years you see it, but there's an intensity of focus on institutions, high politics, political parties and so on. And it tends to ignore the great mass of people. Now, the great mass of people, the working class people, don't leave records behind. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not entirely the fault of historians either, because you have to be innovative, really, in your methodologies in order to uncover the voices of people. But even looking at things like Cork case, like I said, looking at the records of charitable institutions, like the NSPCC is one of the examples in this book. And also looking at oral history, which hasn't really developed in any real extent in Ireland. And that's dealt with in quite a few chapters in this book. But also looking at how, given a sideways glance, if you will, to how the media and so on portrayed people in general, the sort of language they used. Looking at censorship laws. Michael Pearce has a very hard-hitting chapter to close the book that deals a lot with censorship. In the main, you have very important working class writers in Ireland that had their works entirely censored. And so, you know, the development of an independent Irish working class culture was completely cut across by state policy. Mm. And it's not some sort of a conspiracy theory at all to say that, you know, the interests of the state were actually aligned contrary to the interests of the working class and actually attempted to stifle any working class voice or resistance wherever it raised its head. That is the reality. That's what happened, and it's well documented, and I think we need to start investigating that sort of stuff.
I think one of the most important ways you can see to economic advancement is education. And if we look at Ireland in the 20th century compared to Britain bringing in a welfare state in 1945, the late 60s before you get free secondary education.
Yeah.
And
it's the 70s, really. I mean, it's brought in the late 60s. Yeah. But
And it's just because we're talking about comparing 1913 to today and comparing different circumstances. On RTE at the moment, they have a show called The Scholarship. It's almost like an X Factor type of, like, comparing kids, who gets the good education out of these children. I remember reading about one of the private schools in Dublin in the 60s that if you got a scholarship, if you were a scholarship boy to wear a different uniform, you had to be let out of class 10 minutes before lunch so you could actually put on an apron and serve the other kids in your class so you wouldn't forget your place. And when you look at how things were different in, say, the north, and people are advancing themselves through education, and in Britain, it seems like a very backward place, the 26 counties, in that late 60s, early 70s, where you still have that push towards modernisation coming in, that youth culture, but still this sort of like conservative break on society.
Yeah, and I think that's actually historiography tends to portray it at a government level as well. So if you look at the introduction of free secondary education and the modernisation really of Irish, the Irish state in the 60s, there's a focus on Fianna Fáil and the changes in Fianna Fáil that led to that.
Lemass and so forth.
Yeah. Exactly, Lemass, yeah. Whitaker, O'Malley and so on. But what was happening in the rest of society, what was happening with the people on the ground who were actually, you know, going to the schools and so on, what result did that have? These are people who are completely ignored, and these are the mass of people in Irish history. And that's again, there's an intense focus on the elite of society in history. And in other countries, you've had a groundswell. A lot of the times it came from the labour movement. It hadn't really obviously been developed to the same extent in Ireland politically. But you had an attempt by younger historians in the 60s and 70s in Britain and France and Germany and so on, who actually had benefited from the creation of welfare states post-war. And you had that first real generation that had benefited from people who had gone on to university and studied history from working class backgrounds and wanted to study people like them and wanted to record the voices of people like them and went out and literally recorded them and developed oral history as a methodology. And that really never developed in Ireland until relatively recently. And similarly to things like looking at the language people use, looking at poetry and so on as a way to express historical ideas, as well looking at the geography, how, in a sense, social engineering, you know, housing and stuff like that, how people lived, what sort of impact this had upon what they thought of themselves, what institutions they created, what power they had in society and what access to power they had. We don't really look at things like that. And I think that there is a new generation of historians who are beginning to look at those questions and beginning to penetrate beneath the established discourse in historiography, are quite inspired by the historians who've gone before them in continental Europe and Britain and the United States who've developed these sort of things. There's a great attempt to share all this now as well, I think. There's a great cooperation, I think, amongst younger historians. We're all in the same boat, really. Again, we're seeing the impacts, I think, of the first and only generation, I think, of free third level education as well, mm-hmm. where people, you know, from working class backgrounds were able to go to universities. And that's been, you know, clamped down with, to an extent now as well, with, you know, higher fees and so on. But that is coming to fruition now, I think, that people are beginning, those people who are from working class backgrounds are beginning to look at themselves mm-hmm. And people like them and to look at new methodologies and so on.
You mentioned grassroots history. Now, one chapter in the book, which is rather interesting, is about pub football leagues and factory football leagues. What does sport have to do with class in Ireland?
Yeah, I think that to an extent, a lot of people play sport anyway, but to an extent where people didn't have access to political expression of their identity, that they could express it through organising sports clubs and so on in their factories. People need, obviously, an outlet outside of work, but people obviously, especially in bigger workplaces, they spend most of their life in work. A lot of their social interaction takes place in work and their communities are often based among the workplace. And people want to develop cultural outlets, sporting institutions and so on that are based on that. So this kind of grassroots stuff takes place throughout the country to this day. It's not just the big bodies like the FAI and so on. But you have people who are trying to organise, you know, five-a-side football teams and so on today. But you have that on a very organised level up until the late 70s, really. And David Thomas deals with that. You have a number of different sports, football, Gaelic, hurling and football as well. Even things like basketball mm-hmm. and table tennis leagues were organised amongst factories and workplaces. And a local area, which linked up on a county-wide level and then on a regional area. So you had Leinster and Munster and so on, factory football leagues and so on. And a lot of the, we tend to forget, I think, as well, a lot of the teams that compete on a national level have their origins in working class organisations that were created around the workplace. So, you know, coming from Cork, one of the main examples is Fortson's, which was created around the Ford workplace. That's a thing which is completely neglected.
Yeah, my dad talks about Transport, which was a League of Ireland team.
Yeah.
It's CIE workers, I think it was.
Yeah.
And Harold's Cross.
And Harold's Cross, yeah, back when they played football there. Yeah. But I mean, one of the things that strikes me about sport, it always has, even when I was a child, was how clearly it manifests social sort of division and the way people express their status. Like rugby traditionally is an upper class sport. They're very conscious of this. They like it that way.
Yeah.
You know, and soccer in Ireland is very quite urban working class sport. And GA is like you were talking about. It's the nationalist thing. They like to say that they're a bit of everything, whether they are or not. Yeah. No, but
there are exceptions to that.
Yeah. It's funny, Dave. There was an article.
There are exceptions. Limerick and
Limerick,
stuff.
Yeah. But, rugby, yeah.
I can't remember who wrote it, but it was about sport in this perception that GAA, if you play GAA, you're a nationalist, all these types of... His argument was, well, there has to be something more to it. You can't go out every
there
Sunday
is, yeah.
morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the issues was about, I think it was a shop assistant tried to set up a rugby team in Cork. And when they went to the IRFU, they didn't really like the idea of shop assistants having their rugby team. And after a while, and they were quoting them ridiculous affiliation fees, they went to the GAA and just decided to turn it into a hurling team because like the affiliation fees were very small. But I think it is really interesting, that idea of how we look at popular culture, like 50 or 60,000 people at an FAI Cup final or a Munster hurling final.
Don't know about 60,000 in fairness.
Well, back in the day, isn't thought to be as important as, you know, a very small amount of people pursuing what would be perceived to be a high culture pursuit. Maybe it's, as you say, about record keeping, or more people would write about going to the opera or things like that, rather than write about their experience going to a big match.
Again, it's serious education and it's free time as well, and access to power and the ability and willingness to write down your experiences and to think as well that you'd have an echo for that and people would be interested in. I mean, working class people in general, I mean, to be working class, you obviously have to work. You work, you know, long hours, you go home, you don't have much time really to develop, and people make a huge effort obviously, especially in recent times, to go on adult education course and so on to develop their abilities and so on. But you're talking about time on one hand, and also society is stacked against you really in terms of, do we really want to hear working class voices? To an extent, there's a genre now that, you know, you have a lot of these memoirs looking back at the good old days and so on in you know, rare inner cities. And yeah, exactly, yeah. But in a sense, they're kind of, most of them are nostalgic, kind of looking over your shoulder as, you know, oh, it might have been bad, but actually, you know, we're great, it's, and we're great sense of community and stuff like that. Yeah. But in reality, the people, like most of the people who write for the newspapers, most of the people who write books and so on, and the people who will attend opera, and so on, are the people who are very educated. They're the elite in society. And I think that is, again, one of the effects now of the free education. You actually are seeing a bit more now among younger people producing independent publications. Things like Rabble and so on are indicative of that. You do have that at certain other times as well. You would have had a strong youth culture in the past, in Dublin in particular as well. Where there were attempts, you know, to choose fanzines and so on.
Fanzines in the League of Ireland were quite big about 15 years ago. The strange thing is the internet has sort of killed them, because people just go on message boards instead.
Yeah.
And that's more to do with technology than anything else.
Yeah. The internet is, I mean, not to get too carried away about the internet, but I think the internet is actually a huge potential for people recognising that they're not alone, and for people to actually be able to realise that their voice counts, and to organise in a, you know, to meet like-minded people and organise around that culturally and politically. It's a great facilitator, I think, and a great leveller really as well. So it kind of, it's not, obviously it's not the answer to the power imbalance that exists in society, but it is a great help, I think.
Well, I think this brings us back to one of the issues within the book. How is working class culture today especially portrayed in the mainstream media, in newspapers, film, TV, compared to, as you say, at a grassroots level with local history societies, internet groups, even like a young songwriter who wants to record songs in his bedroom has the technology now that he wouldn't have had 20 years beforehand. But especially if we look at what is perceived to be working class culture on RTE, it's absolutely dreadful.
The working class in general in the mainstream media is portrayed as, you know, inept, feckless. You know, you have problems, huge problems with drugs, not just unemployment, but unwillingness to work. And that's the sort of image that's portrayed. And it's not accurate, you know, it's not accurate. It ignores the great mass of working class people. And furthermore, it actually ignores, I mean, there are areas where, you know, there are big drug problems, big problems of crime, but it ignores the causes of those things and doesn't attempt to address them. And what's more, it completely ignores white collar crime altogether. It lets people, you know, like who are involved in fraud and so on off the hook. Really, why don't we have, you know, shows trained those? I mean, the Anglo tapes were a good indication of that sort of culture that exists, but we don't get that really that much. We have programs like Love Hate, which is, you know, a good program, but it does portray working class people in the main as, you know, criminals, and there is a role for programs like that are well made and are hard hitting. But the problem is there's no other programs currently in existence in Irish media that show the other side of that. It's almost as if everything is that you have programs like California as well, which is dealt with in the book, which makes a mockery really of working class people. And there's this general idea as well of the coping classes, which exists, not working class, as if, you know, coping is, it's actually quite insulting, I think, the coping classes. But this is mainstream discourse.
Yeah, it's like decent people don't complain.
Yeah.
They sit home and cope about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the other side of the coin would be something like The Wire, which goes in very great depth into the causes of social problems.
Absolutely, it does, yeah. And I mean, The Wire is a good example. It shows,
which is set in Baltimore, of course, for people who don't know, in America.
Yeah, not West Cork. Yeah, I mean, problems like The Wire, where you have crime, for instance, on the Docklands, but it shows the effect of deindustrialization on society. It actually attempts to address those issues head on, whereas programs like Love Hate, you know, they're all action, basically, drama. They don't really attempt to address how drugs and drug issues really come about, and the other societal problems that do exist in working class communities, crime, prostitution and so on. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really attempt to deal with these and why people are driven to get involved in these sort of activities.
Yeah, I mean, The Wire is obviously just a TV programme, but one of the things I liked about it was it shows you, for example, why a kid would go to school and not want to learn or go to school and cause trouble. It's not just because of inherent badness. It's probably because they come from a really damaged background.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not nice to be a teacher in that situation. What was good about that fictional show was it gave you some idea of why it might be true.
Hmm. I mean, I think the idea is that if you go down to the Rotunda tomorrow and you look around and you see all the babies there and there's no difference between them. Mm-hmm. I think that everybody is born more or less exactly the same, and that it's society and the conditions in society that determine how that person will grow up and what sort of opportunity they'll be given and what sort of life course they'll take. And that comes down, I think, fundamentally to class in society and to power. I think that there are reasons why people turn to drugs and to crime, and that there's always an attempt to portray these things as inherently bad from a moral perspective without really addressing why these things happen. The people who are involved in crime and people who take drugs and so on they're not born with a notion that this is something that they're going to do in life. Society and the conditions that they live in will determine that. That's not addressed at all. And also, there's no real attempt to portray the positive aspects at all. You don't see positive working class role models on a national scene at all. You see these programs. Obviously at a community level, it's completely different. But the levers of power and the media are completely closed off to working class people, unless, of course, there's a conscious attempt to do this as well. There are some people who are, you know, working class people done good, you know, who rise up through the ranks and then are portrayed. Oh well, you know, anybody could do this, but they're numbered in the ones or twos. You know, it's not. That doesn't actually help address the societal imbalance at all.
Well, unfortunately, we're coming towards the end now, but I'd just like to ask you, David, what impact do you think 1913 has had on the wider working class community this year? The commemorations, books, talks, lectures, what impact do you think it's made on the people who have attended these or read or watched programmes about it?
I hope it'll get people to think about contemporary society and about the place of the working class in history. I hope it'll get people to reflect upon this isn't something that's just happened long ago to people who have no relation to me. I hope that people will think that this is something that happened to people who are like me, who continue to exist to this day, and actually that the fundamental divisions and conflict that the 1913 lockout was about still continue to this day, and that they will want to find out a bit more about that and hopefully, you know, do something. Because at the moment, I think contemporary Ireland is in a crisis, and we need to find a way out. And I think without understanding class and looking at society from a class perspective and understanding the role of the working class, the history and culture of the working class, we can't really begin to address those issues.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. We could have probably talked for another hour. Thank you very much to Dr. David Convery. And Locked Out, A Century of Irish Working Class Life, is available now from all good bookshops. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please go to the Near FM podcast page on nearfm.ie/podcast. From myself, Cathal Brennan, and my co-presenter, John Dorney, thank you for listening to the Irish History Show on Near FM.